You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. I've got two guests for you this week. In a little bit, we will talk with Liz Pollack about restaurants in Santa Cruz County that are no longer around. But first, we talk with Neil Bascom, and he's the author of several exciting histories, including The Winter Fortress, The Epic Mission to Sabotage Hitler's Atomic Bomb, Hunting Eichmann, How a Band of Survivors and a Young Spy Agency Chased Down the World's Most Dangerous Nazi, The Escape Artists, A Band of Daredevil Pilots, and The Greatest Prison Break of the Great War. His latest tale is called Faster, How a Jewish Driver, an American Heiress, and a Legendary Car Beat Hitler's Best. It's a classic race car story, plus Nazis. Neil Bascom, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, wonderful to be here.
Hitler's Germany is a fascination for lots of readers, including me, and apparently you. But what accounts for this unquenchable thirst for stories from that era?
Well, just, you know, I mean, it's the line is very clear in terms of the good guy and the bad guy in many instances, and just the sort of just wealth of stories that have come out of World War II. I mean, I've come across other stories that I thought I'd never heard of and looked into it, and wow, there's a book on it or a documentary. I mean, there's just such an array of different stories from every angle, and I was lucky enough with Faster to find one that sort of hadn't been plumbed before and that really in many ways was kind of the Jesse Owens story of the 36 Olympics, but with race cars. And a Jewish driver. And I just, you know, from that point on, I was just sort of absolutely captivated. I first learned of the story when I read an article about the Concorde Pebble Beach and this little quirky car that kind of looked like a praying mantis that had been restored from pre-war. And it turned out that this Delahaye car had been sought after by Hitler, and he tried to destroy it and all that. And that just intrigued me to kind of wanted to know more. And so I often find that with World War II stories that just have this wonderful David and Goliath aspect to it.
So you've actually seen the car that's used in the story?
I have. I've seen the car. I've driven in the car. I went with the owner of there were four Delahaye Grand Prix race cars ever built. Three of them are owned by a collector named Peter Mullen, and one is owned by another collector named Sam Mann. And Peter had restored one of his cars to its sort of Grand Prix racing form with the V12 engine and, you know, it's open seat. And it's just an absolutely exhilarating, terrifying ride. You kind of feel like you're in a sled. You're that close to the ground, and you're sort of positioned in that way. And as I wrote kind of the author's note, it kind of feels like you're flying when you're inside it.
Have you always been an aficionado of cars and car racing?
I haven't. You know, I really wasn't a car guy growing up. I mean, my grandmother had this beautiful ruby red 68 Mustang that I kind of marveled at, but she never let us go in it. She was very protective of that car. And subsequent to that, you know, I've had an array of sort of inexpensive utilitarian cars. I have a couple of friends who are big car fiends and have ridden in their sort of exotic cars before. But no, not really. I mean, for years I tried to find a racing story just because the atmosphere of it, the culture of racing I find fascinating. But I really couldn't find a good entry point until I heard about this Delahaye story, and I was kind of in it. But, you know, at the heart of this story, it's, you know, kind of like, you know, a story about pilots and B-17 bombers in World War II that Laura Hildenbrand has made famous. Like, the car, in many ways, is just, you know, to use the cliche, the kind of vehicle for the story. It's really about these individuals, Renee, Lucy, and the company Delahaye that really sort of drives this story forward.
I talk about Laura Hildenband. It's kind of a Seabiscuit tale, only there's a car instead of a horse.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, I loved Seabiscuit when I first read it, and you know, I even make note in an early part of the book the sort of inspiration for describing how famous the Delahaye car was, even though today probably very few people have even heard of the auto manufacturer. Much like very few people had probably heard of Seabiscuit until she made it famous. And so I sort of tracked back in the book, like, how big of a marker this story was of Renee and the Delahaye and Lucy Schell. It really was huge news at the time.
Yeah, so you were just mentioning, Neil Bascom, the cast of characters in your story, and I want you to take a little time and tell us, who are all the people?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, first, and maybe not foremost, but first in the cast is really Renee Dreyfuss. Renee was from Nice, French, was, you know, fascinated by cars from a very early age, grew up driving Bugattis around the sort of hills of Nice, won his first major Grand Prix race in 1930, kind of with a gimmick of putting an extra gas tank on his car seat so he didn't have to stop. And subsequent to 1930, he was really, you know, became one of the top Grand Prix drivers in the world. He was very steady, very precise, not necessarily aggressive driver, but he kind of pushed the car to where it needed to be. The problem was, because of the rise in nationalism in Europe in the mid-30s, particularly with, obviously, Italy, Mussolini, and in Germany with Hitler, René found himself in a position where he was banned from the best teams and driving from the best cars because of his Jewish heritage. His father was a Jewish faith. His mother was Catholic. René really didn't care about religion, as he often said, you know, driving is my religion. But with his name, Dreyfuss, which is probably one of the most famous Jewish surnames in Europe, you know, he was tagged as Jewish and ultimately sort of ostracized because of that. And so really by 1935, 36, he's kind of a jockey without a horse. He can't find a car to race. And that's the sort of setup for where Renee meets Lucy Schell, who's the sort of other key principal in the story. Lucy was the only child of a rich American industrialist. She was born actually in Paris because her mother was French. She split her time between the two places. And, you know, she was, you know, I loved writing about her because she was such a brash, aggressive, say-what-you-think individual. She was one of the earliest speed queens, the female race drivers. She was one of the best American Monte Carlo drivers. She famously, you know, entered one race with a broken arm and almost won it. And she had all this money and all this time, and she had a family and a supportive husband. But by 1935, 36, she decides that her kind of racing career as a driver is over, but she doesn't want to end, and she wants to kind of take on the Germans. And so she becomes the first woman to start, fund, and run her own Grand Prix race team. And she selects Renee Dreyfuss to be her top driver.
Were there a lot of women in racing at that time?
There, you know, there were a few handfuls, is probably the best way of putting it. I mean, they did not really compete in Grand Prix events, but they were, you know, many women, including Lucy Schell, were some of the best long-distance endurance race drivers. So races like the Monte Carlo Rally or other city-to-city events that were, you know, very tough, rigorous, events, and they excelled in those greatly. So there was, you know, they raced against men, they raced solely against women in different events, and they could compete almost on a weekly basis.
And was she Jewish as well?
She was not. She was, of indeterminate faith, I think it was probably best said. Again, her, like Renee, I mean, her focus and love was driving and embracing. But what she saw in Renee was this driver who was very good, but after a terrible crash that Renee suffered in 1933, he had lost a lot of his aggression, and he kind of needed to be re-inspired. And that's the kind of critical role that Lucy played. And Lucy was, in World War I, she was a nurse. She had seen what the Germans had done in that war, and kind of carried over into the 30s this sort of bitterness towards the Germans. And after the Hitler's Silver Arrows, his Grand Prix race teams was dominating the race car world, she decided that someone needed to show them up, and that if no one was going to do it, she was.
And was Hitler personally interested in his race car industry?
He was. I mean, he was quite interested. I mean, as I knew in the book, the second speech he ever gave after rising to power was at the 1933 Berlin Motor Show, where he set out a very ambitious program to revitalize the German automobile industry, cutting taxes, shedding unions, starting number two to starting the a national highway program, the Autobahn. Third, creating a people's car, a sort of inexpensive, economical car for every German. And fourth, to, as he said in his speech, to dominate motorsport. And so, he had a great love for Mercedes in his early campaigns in the 20s and the early 30s. He went from town to town in Mercedes cars that were donated to him. And so he had an affinity towards Mercedes, and once he rose to power, he poured millions of marks into the coffers of both Mercedes and Auto Union, which was a kind of rival firm, to build Grand Prix race cars that would be the most technologically advanced, the fastest, and to rule motorsport. And really to do that for two reasons. One, as sort of almost advertisement for those automobile companies, but two, and probably most importantly, as a propaganda means to prove that the Third Reich was the greatest. And I think, the third thing I would say, also important, the reason he was doing it is he wanted to engage the German population, particularly German youth, to learn how to drive, because in his mind, always in Hitler's mind, was the sort of future of war and of mechanized infantry, and he needed drivers for that. And by promoting motorsport, he promoted people to be interested in that, and it was very successful.
And so there's also a counterpart to René Dreyfuss, a Nazi driver, right?
Yes, I mean, there's this individual named Rudy Caracciola who, was just so interesting. What I loved about writing this book was just I've written a fair number of books, as you introduced, but I try not to feel like these characters are always my favorite, the ones that I'm writing most recently about. But I have to say, the individuals in Faster, from Renee to Lucy to Rudy, just kind of burst off the page. And Rudy, in particular, was kind of this, top German driver, but in 33 suffered a really tragic accident that left him permanently hobbled. Subsequent to that, 4 months later, he lost his wife in a skiing accident. So on a sort of root level, you feel for him. What happens is, like Renee, life for him was racing. And so he wanted to be in the fastest cars. And in 34, when Hitler was, announcing his Silver Arrows race team, joining that team and coming back was everything to Rudy. He basically said, if I don't have racing, I don't have a life. So he was willing to jeopardize, in many ways, his soul to race again. He wasn't a fervent Nazi, wasn't an ideologue in any way, but he was willing to become kind of, you know, a symbol of the Third Reich, and a symbol for Hitler, just so he could drive. And so it was just, I found it a very fascinating kind of character and individual to write about and to get to know.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking with Neil Bascom. He's the author of several exciting histories, including Sabotage, The Mission to Destroy Hitler's Atomic Bomb, The Nazi Hunters, The Winter Fortress, and his new book, Faster, How a Jewish Driver, an American Heiress, and a Legendary Car Beat Hitler's Best.
Well, it's a history book, but it has a feeling of a journalism. Were you a journalist originally?
I was originally a journalist. I graduated college a while ago now, and my first job out of school was I was a journalist in London for a magazine, and then I was a journalist in Ireland for a while, and then I did a spell in Paris. And so my early sort of writing, researching, interviewing was all journalism, but I kind of always knew that I wanted to be an author. I liked the longer form. I liked having more time, and, so I went for it.
And what kind of research does a book like Faster require from you?
You know, they're all different. I mean, this particular story, because these events happened in 1930, I mean, obviously I didn't have any of the principals who were alive. And, you know, unlike, let's say, my book Winter Fortress, which was about the sabotage of the German atomic bomb program, which, you know, in some ways has been written about a lot. There's memoirs from Norwegians, there's history books on it, there's lots of archives. This was a story that, you know, really, once war broke out, was kind of lost, and people didn't know about it. And part of it was Hitler wanted to erase it. So he had taken all the race records and everything and had them destroyed. And so researching this book was kind of like inventing the wheel. I had to sort of go to the families of all these individuals and find what I could from them. And then, you know, I spent a good deal of time in Europe at all these automobile clubs, whether in Nice or in Monaco or in Germany, and getting information from them. And I think that probably other great source that I had, which I didn't really know going into that I would have, was just an absolute wealth of magazine and newspaper articles that were written at this time. I mean, some of the best journalists and the best writers wrote about Grand Prix racing. And so the descriptions, whether it's a French writer or an Italian or a German or an English or an American, I mean, they just wrote exquisitely, and they interviewed their subjects, and they were at the races, and they gave you the visceral details. And sort of collecting all those was the way that I was able to, you know, chronicle some of these races almost as if you were there. Hopefully you get a feeling of the speed and the danger and the smell of the oil, all because I had all these contemporaneous accounts of what these races were like. And I think I'm probably most proud of resurrecting Lucy Schell, who, again, you know, was very much a pioneer and, you know, the first woman to own and run her own Grand Prix racing team, and no one has heard of her name. And so researching her, going to her family house, and going to all these little provincial villages in France and finding information and stories about her was, you know, was fun. And my wife says that I pick my books based on where I want to travel next, which is very nice. But in this case, I think I won in terms of the travel and the research for the story. It was pretty magnificent.
Well, and simultaneous to the publication of Faster, you have a young adult version of the book?
So you know, probably 8 or 9 years ago, I guess, 8 years ago, I got a call from an editor at Scholastic Books, her name is Cheryl Klein, and she's just a terrific editor and a terrific person. And she works at Arthur Levine Books at Scholastic, and she had read Hunting Eichmann, which was my book about the hunt and capture of Adolf Eichmann. And she said, you know, I think this would make a great book for young adults, this story and the way you tell it. You know, can you just take your 110,000-word, you know, 400-page book and turn it into, you know, half that size geared towards a young adult audience, you know, teenagers and the like. And that book was eventually became Nazi Hunters and was very successful and probably, you know, was one of the most rewarding experiences I've had as a writer because I felt like I got to open up this story to a whole different audience and one that's, you know, in formative time in their life and these stories who I think are important, that story about justice. And so subsequent to that, I've done two others and faster. The adult book will be turned into a book called The Racers for the young adult audience. And it's, you know, it's fun and I love doing it. And actually my next book will be an original for Scholastic about the Gandhi Salt March in 1930. I'm going to try to do an original book instead of writing an adult and then converting it.
I'm curious, when you're converting, you have to change the words? You have to make the sentences more simplistic, or what?
You know, that's what I thought, and that was my instinct when I did Nazi Hunters. I was like, oh, I gotta rewrite this thing, right? I mean, I can't, these complex sentences and, you know, the words that I use, I can't use polysyllabic words, what am I gonna do? And the editor, Cheryl, was like, you know, I want you to just take the book and kind of cleave off the parts that, you know, that are rich context for an adult book that kids aren't going to worry about. So, for instance, in Faster, I'll tell the story about Renee Dreyfus's upbringing in a chapter, you know, a long 4,000 or 5,000-word chapter. In the young adult book, that'll be 1,000 word. That may be 3 paragraphs. Because really, at the heart, what you get in the young adult book is kind of the book stripped down to its narrative core. And I don't really change the syntax, and I don't really change the sentence structures that much. It's really more a cutting down effort and an elimination of context in many ways. And I will admit that it's a very hard thing to do, and so I actually have an editor who I've worked with for over 2 decades who takes the book initially and says, okay, this is what I think we should cut. And then her name is Liz, and Liz and I work together to make that happen.
And have you heard from young people who've read your books?
Oh, I hear from young adults all the time, which again is probably one of the more rewarding parts of writing this, reaching out and doing, you know, hearing from students, going to schools. You know, I just did the other day a sort of live Skype chat with a classroom, and so I do that pretty frequently, and it's just, you know, it's wonderful.
Well, Neil Bascom, tell us a little bit about some of your other books. I mean, you've written, how many books have you written?
It's hard to say because I kind of, you know, more than 10. It depends on if you consider, like, okay, so Hunting Eichmann and Nazi Hunters. Well, that's 2 books. So I've written 9 adult books, and they range from everything. My first book was called Higher, which is about the skyscraper races in New York in the 20s. I was always have been a big architecture person, so it's the story of the Chrysler Building and the Empire State. Wrote a book called Perfect Mile about Roger Bannister breaking the 4-minute mile. I wrote about a Russian mutiny called Red Mutiny, about the Potemkin Uprising, which Eisenstein made famous in a movie. So just an absolute range, and people often are curious, you know, what the sort of common thread of these stories are. And at the heart of it, I was saying the other day to a friend, they're kind of, I'm kind of just replaying the story of Red Dawn over and over again, kind of the story of the underdog who, you know, sort of takes on the challenge. And those are the stories, for one reason or another, attract me. I like inspiring stories. And you know, those are the stories that I feel like, you know, we could use more of.
I agree. Do you have a whole lot that are rambling around in your head that you can't wait to get to?
I do. You know, I always have like one or two that I'm batting around in my head or doing preliminary research on. For instance, this Gandhi story. You know, I've been toying with this for 6 or 7 years now. I did research in England, you know, 5 years ago, spent a month there doing it, and but other projects sort of came in, and so I backed away from it. And but it's just one of those ideas, one of those stories that have clung to me, and those are the ones, you know, different windows in time are the right ones to write a specific book, and so I kind of wait for those. And my next adult book, I'm battering around a couple of ideas, you know, friends and family and other people are constantly saying, you should write about this or that. sometimes, very seldomly do I take them up on it, but you never know where the next good ideas might come from. And so I'm happy to entertain any of them.
Well, this book is really exciting, and it's a great read. And it's called Faster, How a Jewish Driver, an American Heiress, and a Legendary Car Beat Hitler's Best. And the author, my guest, Neil Bascom. Neil, thanks so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Neil Bascom, his new book is called Faster, How a Jewish Driver, an American Heiress, and a Legendary Car Beat Hitler's Best. I'm Gary Shapiro. You are listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. There's a new book that I want to tell you about that's so nostalgic. I just love it. It's called Lost Restaurants of Santa Cruz County. And the author is Liz Pollack, and she's a bookseller as well as the author of this little gem. Liz Pollack, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you so much for having me as a guest. I appreciate it.
Well, I love this book. How did you come up with this idea?
You know, my thing to collect is vintage restaurant menus and cocktail menus and wine lists, and I have a lot from Santa Cruz, the city and the county and Aptos and all that. And I was looking at some very closely, and I saw this little blurb on the bottom that was printed, the ceiling prices are available for anyone who wants to see them, and they're posted by a rule of the Office of Price Administration. And I didn't really know what that was, and so I researched that a little bit. And so in the 40s, because of World War II and the ration coupons, restaurants were also it was imposed on them to get ration coupons, which they did, but at a 20% to 30% more allotment. But in doing so, they had to post these posters and little blurbs in their menus that whatever they I could go on and on, but whatever they charged was going to be that way for the year. They couldn't, like, you know, jack up their prices or something. And that was a way to regulate fairness. But it was tough. And so I invest to that, and then I started writing, and the book kind of built up from there. I interviewed 78 people, and I covered about 200 restaurants.
It's just a great little book, and like I say, it's very nostalgic. And I was reading about the author part, and you and I came to Santa Cruz the same year, 1975.
Awesome.
And my first trip to Santa Cruz was in 1973, and I think the first restaurant where I ate was the Broken Egg.
Oh, yeah.
And then there were two Broken Eggs, but this was the original Broken Egg.
Uh-huh.
Which was underneath.
Larry Hutcherson, yeah.
Underneath the staircase massage parlor.
Right near the, it was fantastic because they were really, added a lot of fresh vegetables. They really emphasized everything was fresh, and it was a meeting place. It was a happening place, and I had the great joy of interviewing Alan McLean, who that was one of his favorite places to go. He's the youngest son of Huldah Hoover McLean. And he graciously talked about all the restaurants he remembers going to. He was a great person to interview. It was my honor to interview the people in my book, whether they were, they worked in restaurants for a short time or they were part of the family that owned and managed the places.
And, you know, some of the wait staff in some of these places also became our friends, and we knew them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about a few things, a few restaurants that I love. There's one restaurant missing from your book that I really loved, which is a restaurant called the Pepper Mill.
I'm sorry.
Do you remember
that? I remember that.
Yeah.
Sure.
It was on Pacific Avenue.
What did you like to order there?
They had open-face turkey sandwiches and open-face roast beef sandwiches.
Dang. Yeah, sounds good.
It was like a cafeteria, kind of. I mean, it was a cafeteria, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, it's where the Barceloneta is right now, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, when I came here, I was so involved at UC Santa Cruz, and that's where I ate at the Whole Earth Restaurant, and I had the joy of interviewing Paul Lee about his involvement in the restaurant and how what a great connection it was with the Alan Chadwick Garden, and that it was the first of the UC system, and in fact, any colleges that he could think of to use the local college garden, in French intensive organic garden, as a purveyor for the restaurant on the campus.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Yeah.
What is the oldest existing restaurant in Santa Cruz? Do you know?
Dagnero's Fish at the end of the wharf.
Uh-huh. You're right. That's an old one.
Right. Fantastic.
Of course, now all the restaurants are, maybe we won't have any restaurants anymore. Who knows?
Well, one of the things that I'm talking about is the through the decades, the flexibility or the initiative of how restaurants can work around, a problem. The creative new thing of this curbside pickup is so incredible. I mean, I love this. It takes a little bit of planning, but it reminds me of in my chapter on the car hops and the drive-ins in the 50s, of when the restaurant owner would extend the parking lot and have the waitresses roller skate out to the car and utilize, if their dining room was full, then they'd utilize the parking lot as an extra dining room.
Isn't that crazy? Well, they don't come out in roller skates now, but maybe they'll reinvent that. I want to ask you about Chef Tong. He was an important person who brought Szechuan cooking. I thought he was the first to bring Szechuan food to Santa Cruz, and I think he originally cooked at the New Riverside Hotel.
Right. And the he got rave reviews from restaurant critics as possibly the first, if not the very first person to really champion Szechuan food in Northern California. It was a big, huge draw to Santa Cruz. I mean, tourists discovered it, and he came out with a book, and I think he came out with some bottled sauces and spices as well.
He was a great guy, a very nice guy. And I remember that he had a restaurant near Pacific Avenue. You have one listed on 41st Avenue. I didn't remember that he had one there, but didn't he have one off Pacific as well?
That I don't know. I'm not sure. I'll look that up. I'm not sure about that.
I think he had one downtown. Yeah, I could be wrong, but I don't think I am. But yeah, he was a great guy, and that was a revolution in food. And then the China Szechuan, which was...
Oh, my goodness.
That was another restaurant before that. What was it called before it was the China Szechuan? Now it's...
It was the Downtowner.
The Downtowner, right.
they
had sandwiches and stuff.
Right, and is near the Penny's department store catalog place where you could order from the catalog and pick it up there.
Right.
But the China Szechuan was fantastic.
Oh, I loved it. I was so sad when they closed. They closed voluntarily. They decided to retire, I believe.
Did you ever work at a restaurant yourself?
I had the shortest restaurant career in history. I worked at a restaurant called Tiny's, which is where the IHOP is now, and I was a busboy there, and I was fired after one night because I was so terrible at it.
Well, then that's the thing. It's like when I was a bartender at Adolph's Italian Family Restaurant from 85 to 1990, there were a lot of waiters and waitresses who, you know, I mean, we all depended on each other, and we had work ethic and all. So there was this guy who'd come, and his shirt was clean, it was always wrinkled. And so the manager, Polly Belondi, she said, "Liz, you know, go in there and help him iron his shirt or something." So then they had an ironing board set up. And I ironed a shirt, and then I married the guy. So, I mean, you meet a lot of people and make a lot of friends at restaurants.
Well, one of my very good friends, Tim, used to be a waiter at Casablanca, and another good friend of mine, Melanie, was a waitress at the Teacup.
Oh, nice.
And my friend Diane was a waitress at India Joe's. So, yeah, I knew all the people there.
Sure.
And some people, they were just our friends because we went in there and ate there.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And a lot of decisions get made there. One of the features that I enjoyed researching was that, you know, Rotary and Elks and all the awards and all the functions, all these monthly meetings brought in a steady income. But it's the bridal showers and the bachelorette parties and all that stuff. You know, it's a big deal.
It is
a huge deal.
Yeah, one of my favorite restaurants I want to ask you about was the Grape Steak. It was on 41st Avenue, where Cafe Cruz is now. And that was such a great place where you would make your own steak, and there was a great big vat of baked beans there.
Oh my goodness! It was. And really fresh food, the best meat, really high quality meat. One of the things I loved to do was promote the idea that it's really the purveyors that keep the business humming. You know, the Sur City Produce, Coast Produce in Watsonville, when they come in, they you don't have to call them for the season. They know what you want. They know what you need. They, well, the computers help that and everything, but it's this community support with the people who, you know, promote the wine and beer, but I enjoyed my interviews with the purveyors as well in Santa Cruz.
The Del Marette was another favorite of mine. In fact, my friend Ava Brzezinski made a film about the original Del Marette. It was such
a
great little hamburger place. I just loved it. And I worked at Logo, so it was right across the street. I used to eat at the Del Marette all the time. What a great old-fashioned Santa Cruz eatery that was.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
In fact, I remember once at Logo's, my co-worker Debbie and I had gone to the China Szechuan, and we had a huge feast that was set up on the back counter there while we were working one evening. And somebody came in, like, eating an apple or something, and Debbie said, "There's no food allowed in here."
Well, I miss Logo's.
Me too. And I miss all these restaurants that you bring to life in this book. It's a wonderful book. Lost Restaurants of Santa Cruz County, and the author has been my guest here, Liz Pollack. Liz, thank you so much for visiting and talking about this book. Where can we find this book, by the way?
Well, you can find it at all independent, locally owned bookstores. Thank you very much. If you could avoid the megastore that begins with the first letter of the alphabet, I appreciate that. Of course, the Cook's Bookcase, which is a local independently owned bookstore, carries it, and I own the bookstore, and I offer free shipping.
So can people around, because, you know, From the Bookshelf has a worldwide audience, so people around the world can contact your store in what manner?
Cooksbookcase.com, and as well as my phone number, which is 831-251-9218.
Well, thank you so much, Liz, and I hope a lot of people pick up this book because it's really wonderful.
Thank you so much, Gary. It was a pleasure talking with you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.